Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hey, everyone. Just before we start the show, I wanted to take a second to say a few words about our very kind sponsors. 100 Resilient Cities is a part of the Rockefeller Foundation, which you'll probably know is one of the world's largest charitable endowments. 100 Resilient Cities is focused on helping cities around the world become more resilient to the social, physical and economic challenges of the 21st century. They're doing some excellent projects in terms of, you know, environmental sustainability, in terms of economic sustainability, and just in terms of, you know, making life generally better for everyone in cities from Manchester to Miami, to Melbourne, to Montevideo. You can find out lots more, including reading up on some of those fantastic projects, at their website, which is 100resilientcities.org. Anyway, now on with the show.
Okay. Oh yeah, don't know where I'm going or where I'd like to leave a little reputation behind me. Yeah. I really need to watch Bugsy Malone again.
That needs to be our intro.
Yeah.
Is this the wrong moment to tell you that I started recording
don't
that?
Don't put...
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Ellidge, and this is Skyline's The City Metric Podcast. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that a few weeks ago we had a guy called Ned on, and we kind of messed around in Victorian London, which was lovely. My mother in particular enjoyed that episode, and I think now Ned is her favourite son. But one of the people who got in contact to say they enjoyed that episode was dropping some, I think, fairly strong hints about maybe talking about a different century. So this week we're going to do the 17th century with the historian and author Rebecca Radil.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for coming all the way. You've come down from the north to see us, haven't you?
I travelled from the north and then I went to Southwark and now I'm here. So I've done the rounds today.
Southwark was of course very big in the 17th century in itself. So, you know, it's really, you're kind of in keeping, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Just about.
We also have an interloper who said that they just really like the 17th century. So, hello, Helen.
It's not my favourite century. My favourite century is, of course, the 18th century. But it's still a good century. I won't have a word said against it. And certainly a really interesting point in terms of architecture, particularly in terms of London and city planning.
So, okay, Rebecca, first question. 17th century, why?
That's a big question. I can give you the honest answer or the lie.
Give us today. Both and then we have to guess which one's which.
Okay, well, the first answer is that I'm very interested in the civil wars and...
That's a lie.
Yes. That's... So the honest answer is we studied Restoration poetry when I was doing my A-levels, and they are really, really dirty.
These You're thinking like the other Rochester and people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was the first time, I think, obviously we reconstruct these memories in our minds, but I think for me that was the first time that I'd actually realised fully that people were actually very human in the past as well.
Right,
they're very, very, I mean, as a teenager reading such dirty poetry like that, I'm... you know. Yeah, Signor Dildo.
There's a one by one of Rochester's friends that, if anything, is almost too filthy. It's about double penetration, and it includes the phrase warring toss, which
being
a word for penis in the 17th century. This is what I spent a lot of my undergraduate English degree doing
Well, brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I was like, wow, there's like really filthy poetry. I didn't kind of think that anyone... Because you sort of come to it with that post-Victorian idea of history, right? Which is that everyone in the past covered up all their table legs, and then we got to the 60s and then everyone started having sex quite openly. And then you go, oh, no. Actually, it turns out before that, we were very much more... The spirit was much more 1960s than 1860s.
Yeah, in the previous
60s.
Is that to an extent because we kind of naturally sort of assume the boundaries... Of sort of social periods kind of fit in with, like, you know, political periods, or whereas, like, it's just the Victorian mores really last well into the 20th century, right?
Yeah, I guess there's a long 19th century that lasts from what the kind of, I guess, from 1790 into like to 1950, if you want to kind of put it like that.
Basically, until John Profumo gets in trouble, really.
Exactly, between Lady Chatterley and the Beatles' first LP.
We're already three centuries off, so this is a great start. So I also should have said, Rebecca, you're the author of a book called 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So we know about the plague and the war. Where does the hellfire come in?
Well, the hellfire is the Great Fire of London, but it's also a metaphor, because fire in the 17th century had multiple meanings. It wasn't just the physical burning orangey thing that we think of. It could also mean hellfire, because this was obviously a very, you know, deeply religious society, so people believed that their actions and their sins could actually propel them into hell afterwards. So that was an idea that was very much in people's minds. Fire resonated in other ways too. It was used as a celebratory thing. So after, I mean, I'm pleased you said you know about the war. That surprises me. The Anglo-Dutch Wars. Not many people.
Oh, John knows a lot about the Anglo-Dutch Wars.
I was on the Civil Wars. But that's cool. So that's the wrong. I'm like 15 years off, aren't I?
Yeah, you are.
50, right? That's fine.
I suppose we're only less than a decade.
Yeah, so it's all related. Time is, you know.
The fire stuff is really interesting, because the big thing that obviously you think of when you think about London, and as you think about the Great Fire, and you think about the building of St Paul's and stuff afterwards. But I suppose in a social context, the restoration of Charles II and his merry, like, footloose, free and easy, you know, loads of mistresses, all this kind of stuff, not getting an heir, all of that. There must have been a lot of preachers around the place going, like, we are heading for eternal damnation. And then a massive fire starts. They must have gone, look, I told you about the eternal damnation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in people's minds as well, there was a group of people called the Fifth Monarchy Men, which may not be out of place in today's politics, although I don't want to talk about politics. But they believed that the end of the world was coming, and that people were living... I mean, this was widespread. It wasn't just with them, but they believed that people were actually living in their last age, and everybody was going to be judged pretty soon. And actually, there was a pamphlet... Sorry, not a pamphlet, a... words escape me now, but a pamphlet that was created, and it predicted things that were going to happen in the future by a man called John Lilly. And within the imagery are pictures, and this is before 1666, of rodents infesting cities, pictures of a fire in a city, and also of maritime warfare. And this was created, you know, a decade or so before. So after the Great Fire, I mean, we're jumping ahead now, but after the Great Fire, he was called in for questioning because his predictions were too accurate.
I'm not sure that predicting a rodent plague and a naval battle was really... I mean, he wasn't straying that far into the realms of craziness.
Did you set off war with the Dutch? So it's quite difficult to kind of, like, fiddle that one, isn't it? It's like... So, okay, set the scene for us a little bit. Like, what's, like, before the fire, before even the plague, which I think comes before the fire, what's it like? What's London look like, and how's everyone feeling about it?
How many people are in it?
Okay, so London at this time is, I refer to it as a metropolis because it is actually a couple of cities and some suburbs. So you have the City of London, you have the City of Westminster, and then you have this suburban sprawl that's connecting the two and kind of tailing off towards the east as well. So that's physically what London is. In terms of the population size, we don't know for absolutely sure how many people were living in the city. There's a statistician called John Graunt who estimated... In 1662, he estimated that there were 460,000 people within the metropolis. Modern estimates have put the figure between 400,000 and 500,000. So it's somewhere around that. This is a city that's always growing.
How big is that window that many in comparison to like the Paris of the day? Like, was it a world, you know, was London a massive city in world
terms?
It was a massive city.
It wasn't larger than Paris. I can't recall the exact estimates, but it wasn't larger than Paris at this time. And the next biggest city were cities like Norwich within England, which had 20 odd thousand people living there.
Wow,
so it's
that's
not
a big gap. It's yeah. Like a so factor of 20.
Yeah. It was huge. But having said that, I mean, when you think about the population in the city now, it was huge, but it wasn't huge in the sense that we would understand. There were communities. People knew each other. There was lots of ways that people linked together, and there were traditions and habits that people had that brought them together, church obviously being the main one. So within your local parish, you would know most of the people by name, probably, if not by face, and you would probably talk to them. So parish community was a big thing. The city is made up of migrants as ever, people that have come from all around the country, from further afield as well. Just to put out a couple of examples, there's a family called the Taswell family that moved to the city in 1660. They've been living on the Isle of Wight. They set up as merchants on Bear Street by the Custom House at the time as well. So there's lots of movement. It's a younger population than the population at large because there were many apprentices coming down into the city. It's also a city that's thought to be unhealthy. There's lots of smoke. We think of like the big smog and Victorian London as being this smoky city, but actually there were complaints about the smokiness of the city because furnaces and things were inside the walls. There was no real rationale as to where these things should be located. They just were where they were. And many people came to the city, and actually, I mean, there's one man called Thomas Elwood who arrived to take up an apprenticeship with John Milton and had to leave after like a year because, well, less than a year, a few months, because the air had got to his chest and it made him ill. He had to leave on other occasions, he went to prison.
But that's one of the notable things when the plague comes, right, is that everyone who can get out of London bails out to their country estate as soon as they possibly can.
And I mean, not everybody that could. There were a significant few that stayed behind. We know Samuel Pepys did. He was out of the city a lot, but came back as well. George Monk, who is this huge 17th century figure, orchestrated the restoration. He remained behind to kind of keep control of the city as well. There are a couple of members of the Royal Society that stayed behind too. Also, after the main part of the Great Plague, so in early 1666, you find little references to people that have stayed behind that you don't notice in the archive from 1666. So Samuel Pepys was talking to one of his friends who'd told him that actually throughout the plague they'd still been going to the coffee house by the Exchange, and a few people had been going to it. So there's a lot leave, but significant few remain, plus the poor as
well. It just makes me think whether or not London during the plague was a bit like it is at Christmas, and you just think, God, this could be really so much nicer if London only had like a tenth of the population. I'd be able to get, like, the roads would be so clear. I wonder, I mean, obviously they're probably not because they were the plague.
It's possible that this is not quite as good an idea as it sounded in your head before you said it.
I don't think that's entirely wrong, though, actually.
I bet someone like Pepys was probably like, it's brilliant, I can get served at the coffee house.
He there's a kind of... Or, I mean, these things were horrible, but he was awed by them as well. He went to Moorfields to go and see if he could find bodies to look at. He did things like this. But then if you...
That's a very 17th century thing, isn't it? It's like, there's no... TV hasn't been invented yet. What am I going to do? Let's go and look at some plague victims.
Find a corpse.
See whether or not they exploded.
Yeah, but he did that. But then earlier on in the century, you get people like Ben Jonson, who wrote a play called The Alchemist, and... That's a satire about plague times. It's a satire about the people that remain behind. And what they do is they stay in their master's house and they take over and they get up to all kinds of nonsense. But the idea that the people that left behind took advantage of the situation is very much there in people's minds.
A bit like Private Walker and all the spivs in Dad's Army. It's like
kind of like that.
But that's why it would be an interesting thing for, I guess, for artists. And like in the same way we've had this discussion about one of the few things that resolves inequality is a really great big war, right? And I guess the plague must have had to some extent that kind of, certainly like the Black Death did whenever it was that happened, it was just really upended society because actually no one was particularly spared. So I guess that London must have had some of that atmosphere of just people are gone. Some people are never coming back. You know, everything's kind of been upended for this. It's almost this kind of like a carnival atmosphere, but you know what I mean? This kind of sense of just everything being up in the air.
Yeah, but also severe tragedy. And there's a kind of a level of dark humour that you do get from archival materials. Samuel Pepys is obviously the best source for plague testimony from this time. And there's hints at that, not from him, because he doesn't tend to do satire in his diary. He's very straightforward and matter of fact. But you get hints of that. But equally, there is that despair and the horror of it all and how it's so unnatural and dehumanising plague. Mm. You get that very much as well. I mean, there are stories of people breaking out of houses that were shut up to try and, to give themselves a chance at life. Because, of course, there's three of us in this room now. If I suddenly started coming down with bubonic plague symptoms, all three of us would be shutting here for 4 weeks. So people would not be allowed to leave.
How much food did people have in their houses that was a thing that they could do then?
Yeah, so there were plague orders that were brought in. And
it's like a sort of plague-based deliveroos.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously these things would have become less organised as the plague worsened. But in an ideal world, if plague hit the city, there were plague orders that stipulated that each household were granted two nurses, and there would be a watchman outside the house, and this is how food and vital things that they needed would be delivered to the people inside the house. There's a really, really heartbreaking testimony from a man named Thomas Clark, who was quarantined in 1666, and he speaks about how they are quarantined within their house, but actually he does not have plague, but his child does, and they have to lock his child in a separate room. They're not allowed to go into the space where the child is for fear of getting plague. And it's written in a kind of, in a poetic way, but the way that he described the awfulness of not being able to comfort your own child when they're calling out for your help. I mean, that's there as well. Mm. And it's really bleak, particularly when you're also looking at, the references to all these people dying on parish burial records. I mean, this is very dark stuff.
But I'm really interested in it because the thing is, it's always presented when you have in that linear view of history as being like the plague happened and that was bad, and then the fire happened and that was bad, but also good because it meant that you got to have a much, different layout of the city. It removed all the slums, which were really unhealthy. But presumably, I mean, in terms of kind of like a refugee crisis, the fire must have just devastated people. And what?
When you're talking about this sort of plague orders and sort of making sure there are nurses and so on, like who is organizing this? Who are the authorities here?
So we have this metropolis. The City of London has the jurisdiction for the parishes within the walls, and then a number of out parishes as well. So that falls under the jurisdiction, in an ideal world, of the Lord Mayor, then the aldermen, but then also the parishes as well. It's the parish, the separate parishes that recruit the women that are allocated to be nurses and also allocated to be searchers. It's the parishes that recruit the watchmen. It's the parishes that recruit the people that are going to bury the dead as well. So it's there's a kind of hierarchy there, but the real kind of nuts and bolts of the organisation comes from the individual parishes. You have two physicians that are mainly in charge of what's going on. One of those physicians is Nathaniel Hodges, and he left a really marvellous testimony from his time as a plague doctor or a plague physician, and it describes his daily process of looking after people. So he would go out to people's houses. There's no indication whatsoever of those plague masks. That's not something that is in 17th century England, but he goes
in. Whoa. Didn't people wear the beaky things?
No.
What?
Yeah.
So where does that come from?
There is imagery from areas in Germany from the 16th century and before that, but there's no evidence whatsoever of, unless somebody wants to counter me, but there's no evidence whatsoever of those beaked
costumes. I can't believe the Germans had cool beaky masks and we didn't.
But we did still, the physicians did still cover themselves. They made sure that there was, because this
they
is...
They would have had like nosegays, right? In the sense that lots of people
They would have breathed things in, but this is the time before modern medicine. So medicine rests on the belief of the four humours, on the idea of miasma being the thing that transmits disease. And, the air is either bad air or good air. So if you have lots of nice scents, then you're going to be free from disease potentially. So when he's going into these individual houses, he's putting together these little concoctions, incense and stuff to burn. He's seeing to the people there as well. But then he also has kind of patients coming to his own house. So he sets up a little kind of doctor's practice in a way, and they come to visit him. One person that visits him is a young girl whose family are in quarantine, and she's managed to break free from the quarantine. And she runs to him and she explains that she's got a growth on her arm. And he writes in his testimony that he was pleased to tell her that it was actually just a wart.
Oh, that's nice.
But we don't hear about her after that point. So who knows? But
there's another, died of melanoma 6 months later.
I know, but there's another arm-related thing. A man believed he had a plague-related markings on his arm, so he asked for his arm to be chopped off, and he died from the loss of blood. I shouldn't laugh, but he's yeah. So there's lots of things like that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, so let's move the story on. What starts the fire?
Well, it is a fire in a bakehouse on Pudding Lane on Sunday the 2nd of September 1666. I mean, we know this from school, don't we? We know that it was a hot summer. We know that London was mainly, although not exclusively, made of wood. We know that there was a wind that was blowing towards the west that encouraged the fire. So,
And that grain is, like wheat is weirdly explosive, right? Because of the way that its structure is. I think this is something that people don't kind of quite get, is the fact that it can almost like gunpowder, I think it can burn grain to grain. Like it can be a dangerous thing to store.
Indeed. And that's what happened. I mean, when the fire initially started within his house, it quickly went outside to all their stores and their storehouse, and that made it even more combustible. And the street, Pudding Lane, was a place that had lots of shops that had combustible goods there, so fishmongers and wine places, oily things. And also,
it's been a great smelling fire initially.
Well, maybe I'm not really thought about the smell. Oh, actually, there are records about the smell of the fire.
Yeah,
but these are related. Sorry, I'm bringing things down to a really dark level. But these are related to the people saying that the smell was of burning corpses. But I guess there was a lot of meat that was burning as well.
Hmm. Like the corpses, really.
Yeah, corpse meat.
Yeah.
How quickly did it spread?
Very quickly. So it broke out at between 1 and 2 in the morning on Sunday. And then it spread along Pudding Lane quite rapidly. They weren't able to... They called the watchman. They called the Lord Mayor, Bloodworth, who we're all familiar with. He tried to organise for fire engines to be brought down. When I say fire engines, I mean a bucket with a squirt on wheels. He tried to organise for these fire engines to be brought down to Pudding Lane to help put out the fire, but they were too... The lanes were too narrow for the fire engines to go down. Some people were pleading with him to pull the houses down. He refused. I can kind of understand why, though, to be honest, because London had lots of fires before. There was no indication that this was going to turn out to be the Great Fire.
Also, London property prices. Like, people are going to be so annoyed if you start pulling down houses, so...
Of course.
But it's really interesting to think about it in the light of other... I mean, we've got a big fire raging on Saddleworth Moor at the moment. You had a horrible fire last year in Grenfell. And not to kind of... It's probably too glib to draw associations between them. But, like, in the fact of, yes, lack of preparation because you don't think this kind of thing is a thing that can happen. And also just totally inadequate responses in terms of knowing what the answer to containing a fire is, right? This is something that runs all the way through that. And it's amazing that that's still something that we really struggle with now. Fire is still this incredibly elemental force in reshaping our environment.
Yeah, ultimately it is, we can try to contain it, but it's an uncontrollable thing. And I think there were methods, I mean, there were tried and tested methods to combat fires during this time, and they did work. They would pull down houses, and this did happen. Obviously, it's harder to get permission to have a house pulled down when the only people living in that house are the tenants and the landlords are living in some country pile, you know, miles and miles away.
So actually, it's buy-to-let landlords, John, you'll be pleased to know, are the real villains.
It's always buy-to-let landlords.
In the Great Fire of London.
Yeah.
So give us some sense of how long did the fire last and how much did it destroy?
So the fire lasted for about four... I could give a tricky answer here. Okay, so the proper fire, the main fire that we think of, lasted for about 4.5 days, although there were reports months later of smoke being emitted from various parts of the ruined city. So, I mean, we could say months, but four and a half days properly, and it wiped out... No, wiped out's the wrong phrase. It decimated about 80% of the city of London, the city of London. And the reason I didn't want to say wipe out is because when we look at Great Fire imagery, we tend to look at maps and it seems to be this flattened space, but that wasn't the case whatsoever. I think people need to have more in their mind kind of Blitz London. There were skeletons of buildings left behind, and the ruins of St Paul's is a fantastic image that was created in 1673, which shows St Paul's Cathedral as a ruin, and it really brings it alive because it's so similar to some of the Blitz imagery that we have, photographs that we have.
Which I presume is its own problem in the sense that if you're left with skeletons that are unstable, no one knows whether or not the best thing to do is go in and rebuild that or to go, and it has to be pulled down because it's unsafe. So yeah. Presumably there were house collapses for months afterwards.
Yeah, there were quite a few deaths from things like that. But also for weeks, months, the City of London, this burnt out area, was a place that people didn't like particularly to go through because there was lots of crime. So there were reports of burglars and kidnappers operating within the ruins. They would kidnap somebody, rob their goods from them and leave them for dead. There were a couple of bodies that were discovered that way. But yeah, I mean, and also there would be people that would go back, because this is a time when it's not necessarily the building that you're precious about, which of course you are, but it's the space. So even though somebody's home has been destroyed, they still own that space. And this is why we get all these issues with these utopian designs of a new London. They could never work in reality because no one person owned London. It was owned by thousands of people. But people would go back to these burnt out spaces that they owned and kind of erect makeshift tents and, you know, homes out of the ruins to try and still operate their businesses and things.
I want to get onto the grand designs in a second, but did many people die from the fire?
I had this question today, so I gave a talk today with some year 10s at a school, which is a very exciting experience but quite terrifying too. But they asked that question. It's a question I'm always asked, how many people died? Because when we were in school, the classic story is that not many people died. You know, figures are usually around 6, 8, 10, 12 at the most. I think if anyone was to give you an answer, they would be lying. There's no way of giving a definitive answer because we don't know definitively exactly how many people were living in the city. There's a comparable fire, the Great Fire of Chicago, happened in the 19th century. And lots of the story of the Great Fire of Chicago is actually quite similar to the Great Fire of London. It happened during autumn time. It had been very hot. It was a very wooden city. It happened it was supposed to have happened in a woman's, she had a farm at the back of her house. So it's supposed to have happened there. But they had better records then in the 19th century, and they estimated out of the population that 250 people died from that, from the Great Fire of Chicago. The population was kind of similar. As a guess, and it is just a guess, but it's a guess rooted in archival research that I've done into parish burial records immediately after the fire, that I would probably say the low hundreds, because we don't know.
I think that's really fascinating. And again, it kind of links to contemporary stuff, which is it's very hard to get accurate death tolls from fires, because it's not just now that London or cities are a place in which people move in, they sublet, they have more people in their house than they should do according to regulations, you know, all of that kind of stuff. People are living irregular lives, and that is not captured in the kind of official records, or you have to kind of prize it out much more, right? And that's a really interesting point of, yeah, contiguity between 1666 and now, and something like Grenfell last year.
I mean, the other thing we were always told as kids is like the Great Fire put an end to the Great Plague that preceded it. Is that true, or is this another one of those things that turns out to be complete nonsense if you actually look at the evidence?
I wouldn't say it's true, no, because the Great Plague was waning off by that point anyway. People were still dying of plague. People were dying of plague during the Great Fire. But no, it doesn't make sense logically, because London wasn't the only city in England, and it waned off everywhere. Obviously, it was the main one, and it had roads going, you know, to other main cities as well. Also, the Great Fire affected predominantly the City of London. The Great Plague had predominantly affected the suburbs surrounding the city. So those ramshackle houses, if we are to, you know, if we believe that the Great Plague was bubonic plague given to people by rats, then those ramshackle houses were still there. So no one really knows for sure why the Great Plague ended. There's lots of theories, things to do with trade, things to do with human biology evolving, things to do with plague biology. I'm not a scientist, so I would be fearful of delving into it.
But the Great Fire did bring on a plague of city redesign plans.
Oh, yes.
It's a nice segue I came up with. Stop doing that face. So like all these plans come forward to like, well, why don't we just start knocking stuff down and rebuilding? It's like in the same way that Baron Haussmann does in Paris 2 centuries later, right? There's kind of these grand plans. Do you want to tell us about those a little bit?
Yeah, some of them I do find hilarious. So it's literally within days of the Great Fire ending, you get... I mean, one thing you were never short of in Restoration London is somebody with a scientific plan for something. And you get plans from Christopher Wren, there are plans from John Evelyn, there's plans from Hook. And these plans are fantastic, and you can see them. If you want to Google them, you can have a look. Christopher Wren's is this kind of, I mean, they're all utopian. And his is this, it's a very tidy and slick design. John Evelyn's isn't too dissimilar, to be honest. They are similar to one another.
Did any of them try for a grid system? That is the kind of classic.
Yeah, they are. They all have grids. The one design that we don't know, but was apparently praised above all the others by the Lord Mayor, was Robert Hooke's design. That's vanished, along with his portrait and all of the other things. So we don't have that design. But my favourite one is a design that was, and these were all... they weren't asked for, they were just given to the king. But my favourite design is a design by a man called Valentine Knight, and it's literally just lines across a page. like just a load of streets going from one direction to the other. So there were all these designs, but they were impossible. They were impossible dreams.
Because of land ownership or because of other issues? I mean, is it just literally there are people in the way who the designers had been pretending didn't exist? Is that the main problem?
It's land ownership. So after the Great Fire, a court was established called the Fire Court, funnily enough, and that was to negotiate through the various claims from landlords and tenants about home ownership and leases and, you know, how long somebody was supposed to be staying in a certain location, how, you know, the dimensions of people's houses as well. So that just gives a These fire cut records, if you to get them out from the library, they are two really thick books, and that's just a calendar of them. These records are extensive. To try and just do away with all of that and design a city from scratch would have been madness, because people are on the edge anyway. They've lost their livelihoods. They are crippled by the cost of war that's going on. They've, you know, just plagues very, very fresh in their mind. The last thing that a king whose father had his head cut off wants to do is antagonise the people anymore by going in and saying, you know, let's just redesign the capital city. It wasn't the king's city. It was the city of the Lord Mayor, the aldermen, the people that were living there as well. These were impossible. And commentators said, I forget who said this precisely, it might have been Clarendon, but they said that, you know, rebuilding the fire won't be as hard as working out all the leases as to who owns, rebuilding after the fire as to working out who owns, you know, the various parts. So it was impossible. But laws were brought into place. There were the Rebuilding Act came in 1667, which did change things subtly, but not to the extent that Christopher Wren would have expected or hoped.
Did this whole sort of cataclysm, both the plague and the war, did it change the sort of the politics of the day or the mood? I mean, does it kind of feed into that sort of devil-may-care attitude you get in the sort of later Restoration drama, or is that from somewhere completely different?
There is a shift, whether it's coincidental or not is up for discussion, but there's certainly a shift in attitudes towards Charles II. He was welcomed in. His restoration was relatively easy. He was welcomed in as king. But then when the plague hit, and then the Great Fire, and then the year after that, the raid on the Medway.
Wasn't he taking great big globs of money off Louis XIV as well, saying that I'm definitely well a Catholic, so that he didn't have to keep recalling Parliament
later,
because they kept
trying
to make him do stuff he didn't want to do?
Later, but nobody knew about that. And nobody knew about that for decades and decades afterwards. But all of that worked, and the fact that he was having mistresses and he was being very open, not the fact that he had mistresses, the fact that he was quite open about the fact he had mistresses, all of that worked to kind of change. It shifted from a honeymoon period to a real like marriage, I suppose. But and that's what it moved from. That's
I guess
they
all
from.
Knew that he, because he, I guess, I don't know whether or not the understanding of infertility was at the time, but there must have been some kind of, why are you not getting children with, you know, it was Catherine of Braganza, wasn't it, his queen?
Yeah.
When you've got all of these mistresses and you're going to leave us to your increasingly Catholic brother that we don't want. So I imagine that towards the end of his reign began to sour people on him quite a bit.
It did. And obviously there was a period called the exclusion crisis where people tried to bypass James the Duke of York as the heir and go straight to one of Charles's illegitimate children, the Duke of Monmouth, or to others. But it wasn't so much of a pressing issue as other, I mean, the exclusion crisis was, and when he came out as being a Catholic, that was, you know, terrible. But it wasn't so much of a pressure as successor problems had been in the past. So it's nothing like Henry VIII not having an heir, because James actually did have
several children,
yeah. And you know, his daughters were healthy. They'd been brought up Protestants. James was only a couple of years younger than his brother. There was no indication that, you know, James would have a long life. Certainly no indication that he would have a child in his 50s.
With Mary Medina smuggled in on the warming pan.
Yeah. Certainly no indication of that. So even though it was an issue when James became king later on, people, until this son came along, people were just thinking of it as a blip. They would, you know,
and then we get Mary
they would
William
get
of
Mary
Orange
afterwards
in.
And William of Orange with all his Protestantism and yeah.
We should probably be wrapping up, but I just want to ask one question. There weren't any sewers in 1660s London, right? So how did that work?
Yeah, well, people just tended to throw things out of their window. It is a bit kind of classic, kind of horrible histories, but people did. There was a process of sewage. People tended to use the rivers, and they tended to use. There was.
In the sense that, like, you would just go and have a crap on the shore.
No, they would take it there afterwards.
Oh, like
there
in a
was
bucket.
Like,
okay,
yeah, but then there's also the fact that the Fleet River was open at this time and stank, and there were plans to cover it over during that period in history, or to turn it into a canal as well to kind of make it a bit more, well, less awful.
The Fleet River on a hot day, you can still smell to this day, in fact.
A lot of fatbergs, as I understand it.
So to sum up, the thing we were told about how hardly anyone died in the fire, that wasn't true. But the thing about people literally flinging feces out of their windows, that was.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see you next time. You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and produced by me, John Ellich. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do consider leaving us an iTunes review. It really helps other people to discover the show. And, you know, the more people get listening to this show, the sooner I can achieve my real goal of world domination for the medium of trains. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.